Live from Discovery One, this is Derailed Trains of Thought.
You know, Tim, I first thought this was going to be a nice, peaceful place with some classical music in the background just kind of floating around.
It is. Well, I mean, it's cool to be at the space.
Yeah, I agree, but I don't know if you've heard the voice.
It's kind of creepy.
Yeah.
I don't know who programmed the intercom guy.
And then I was just walking through the hall and the airlock right behind me opened up, and luckily I got through the next passage, but
that's a little concerning.
Yeah. I think this may not be as pleasant as I'd hoped to just be. You know, we're on our way to Jupiter.
Yeah.
I can see out the window there.
Everything the movies have led me to believe about space travel is that it's a nice, safe thing to do. And
yeah,
this seems to be completely
and everyone can
wrong.
Hear you scream. Oh, wrong place. But
man, what movies about space have I watched? Now I think about it. Well, while we still have air to breathe,
yeah,
we should make sure we get this podcast recorded. And hopefully afterwards we will get you back to a safe place because, Nick, I hear you are a father.
I am.
Again.
I am a father. I have been for 6 years, Tim. Yes. Mercy, my newest daughter, about a month old as of this recording. Well, 4 weeks, which is not quite a month, mm-hmm. You know how things go.
Mercy, what's her middle name?
Esperanza.
That's
it's
right.
Portuguese for hope, and I always butcher it. And Natasha will eventually beat it into me. But she, for those of you who don't know, my wife grew up in Brazil. And so it's kind of nice to have some Portuguese in one of our names.
And it's kind of sort of ironic. You've had your first son has a Russian name.
Russian name, yeah, because we're all very Russian. Well, Nicholas, Natasha, it made sense.
It works.
It made sense at the time.
Serenity doesn't really have any other namesakes, does she, that I know of?
Well, just Rennie Jones.
Well, but I mean, that came after the fact.
No. Well, her middle name's Anne with an E.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, for those Anne Green Gables fans out there.
Okay. Serenity with a Y and Anne with an E.
Yep, Anne with an E, yep.
And Hayden with a Y.
Yes.
Not Hayden.
And an E, too. E-N and not just
Oh,
N.
right. So yeah. All right. Any other names we need to spell before we go on?
No.
Okay.
I remember there was in middle school in the library, there was some book called like Susan the Five is Silent. Her name was like S-U-5-A-N or something like that. I don't know. I just remember the title. I never read any more of it, but yeah.
That makes me wonder how old of a book that was. Because in Peanuts, there was a character named Five. Apparently because his dad was like annoyed by all the numbers that were taking over modern life. This was in the 60s,
yeah.
Mind you. And so he decided that he renamed all his family after like numbers. And so there was this character Five and his twin sisters, 6 and 7.
That's awesome.
Or something like that. But
all right. Well,
so,
we're going to air quick here, Tim. So we better get to...
to our story school?
Yes.
Story school today, we have a topic that has been on our list for quite a while and
yes,
kept getting pushed around, but finally we're going to tackle it and see if there's as much to it as we thought at one time. But that topic...
Well, don't go straight to it. We'll be around the bush a little bit.
No, we need to talk around it for a little while and then sort of eventually imply what we're going to talk about.
Yes.
Okay. Well, anyway, the topic is the arts of implication. If... that wasn't a ham-fisted hinting enough for you.
Hint, hint. Nudge, nudge, wink, wink. Don't you know?
Yeah. So I thought it would be interesting, Nick, to start this conversation off with actually looking at a definition of implying.
Oh, we're pulling out the Webster's.com.
Yeah, sort of.
Okay.
Anyway, according to my Mac dictionary, maybe it's from dictionary.com. I forget where it comes
from.
Oh, man,
that's not Webster's.com.
I know. But anyway, implies strongly suggests the truth or existence of something not expressly stated. And how does this come into storytelling, Nick?
Well, you can either say stuff straight out, which we talked about in our exposition podcast way back when.
Uh-huh.
Or you can imply it. You can show, not tell would be the most normal way to say it. But there's more layers than simply showing. Sometimes it's plot points that you don't say outright, but the audience can connect the dots.
You hint at it.
You hint at it. There's, and sometimes things that aren't important, but it just to little things that, like, you really dig deep, like, oh, that's there.
Color the background a little
bit. Or sometimes it's things that characters do that later on you're like, oh, those were all clues. You know, mysteries do this a lot. You know, where there will be certain turns of phrases or words they use or things, and you're just like, what? You know, and they're soft-footing it.
It can almost be seen as an Easter egg, but depending on how much stock you put into it, there can be a whole lot more to the story underneath.
Yeah.
If you apply, like, I guess when we talked about the Searchers, Brian pointed out that on one of the tombstones, it said the John Wayne's character's, like, mother family relation. And so there was some sort of connection to why John Wayne had a prejudice against Apaches in that movie. So, I mean, and that's like...
It's different than saying, I hate sand, and then, you know, that's more overt.
Well, yes.
I had to throw that in there.
I mean, and that's, like I said, that's almost an Easter egg that, like, you'd be hard to spot that on your first or even your second viewing. But then you see that, and like, ooh, I'm going to make a whole conspiracy theory out of it, which is a very popular way to talk about movies online nowadays.
That's
it seems
true.
Like.
Yeah, like, all the Pixar films are in the same universe.
Or Jar Jar was really evil.
Yeah.
Or et cetera. But that's not to say that there aren't cases where the storyteller is purposely putting little hints in there to lead you in a certain path.
Well, you know, every once in a while I like to make fun of Ernest Hemingway on this podcast. Uh-huh. But from one of my understanding, his idea was that the story you're reading is like the tip of the iceberg. And so you're seeing 10%, and there's a lot of emotions and feelings beneath that aren't stated. And when you read Hemingway, you really have to read it that way. Otherwise, it comes off as very, like, bland and non-important. But you've got to read into it all the stuff underneath.
Right.
So Ernest, I mean, anyone who does this sort of very sparse type of writing style tends to hope they're implying things.
And if they're not, they have a very boring book on their
hands. Exactly. I think my guess is things like, I think we've talked about The Road on here, book.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the facts, but because the facts are related so bare bones, there's this weight of emotion beneath it.
Well,
I think that's the idea behind it.
Well, and it leaves the reader more room to interpret things, to kind of dig deep for themselves and not just be spoon-fed all the information.
And implication is not quite the same as ambiguity.
Yeah, no, it's different.
In my own writings, I sometimes am relatively ambiguous. But I think sometimes I want to imply the meaning or imply the theme, because you say it outright, it's a little ham-fisted.
Yeah, and that's where we talked about sometimes the author getting a little too preachy. Like, and, you know, obviously we've talked before about not burying your message so deep that no one can get it.
Yeah, and that's the problem. Yeah, I've wrestled with finding that layer well.
But if you can tell your story in such a way that people dig for the message themselves, and by really putting the thought into it, then that helps them internalize it more for themselves, and rather than just like, oh, I must do this because the story told me to.
From the audience's point of view, implication, as opposed to outright stating things, it involves them deeper in the story, or it requires them to be deeper involved to really get it. Because you're having this give and take, like, that you're having a, you know, reader response. You're betting on a reader response as opposed to telling them what they should feel or what they should think or how they should connect the dots.
Mm-hmm.
You're leaving the dots there and hoping that they will pay attention enough and care enough to work with it.
And there's certainly different extremes about how you can do that. I talked way back a long time ago about Pickpocket, directed by Robert Bresson, who definitely believed in he had a very specific way he wanted his actors to work, a certain style, where they didn't show very much emotion at all.
Mm-hmm.
And the audience basically sort of had to read into it, almost as if they were wearing a mask in a Greek tragedy.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't even mention that.
And so they sort of had to read into, you know, what the character was thinking behind his kind of very blank, expressionless face, which sometimes I wonder if George Lucas beside himself was trying to do that with the Star Wars prequels.
I feel like, and again, this is a slightly off track, I feel like he purposely, especially with Anakin and especially the second movie, The Love, I think he must have been having a specific style he wanted.
Mm-hmm.
You don't do it like that
naturally. Yeah, I don't think you do either. I mean, a lot of people will say, no, it's just bad directing. Well, he was directing them in a certain position, and I think he was very purposely aiming for this kind of...
I think an old school, a very old school film critic only understands.
Which, and honestly, probably wasn't... I'm not saying it was the best idea, because most audiences have no idea, but George Lucas has always had this kind of auteur vision of himself, and it just seems like the sort of thing he would try to do.
Now, since we're on visuals now, in visual media, one way to be imply is that is the emotion. We talked about last episode with music, you know, the music really undergirds the emotion.
Underscores
it, heightens it. But the actor can communicate a lot with just a little, with eyes or with a twitch of the mouth or Tim and I's favorite example for this would be...
You know it's coming.
Wild Wild West. No. No, Lost.
Lost, Come on.
But we've been, if you're not listening to The Weekly Hijack, you should. But we've been watching Lost, and we're amazed with how many clues are just in facial expressions about things and drop lines or just normal interact, like whole conversations take place with Jack and Locke looking at each other.
Just those actors, and the best actors in that show can communicate volumes with just the stare.
Yeah.
Which is not an easy thing. I mean, there's a big difference in acting between on the stage and for the camera. On stage, you know, you want to be very expressive and very played to the back of the house. And camera, you have to be very kind of minute and keep those expressions realistic. But at the same time, you still have to be expressionist. I mean, unless you're unless you're working for Robert Bresson, you have you still have to communicate things with your face. And it's a different style of communication than you would use in real life.
Yeah.
Normally in real life, people are very guarded about their personal expressions, and they're not like going to go through these like
Dramatic. They wear it on their sleeve. You know?
Yes, it's going to be one or the other, you know, usually. But for a lot of, well, okay, yeah. Certain people, they can't hold it in at all.
They'll be trying to be normal, but you can tell body language, 90%.
That's true. So it does really depend on the person. But the actor, they have to harness that. They have to make it real somehow, expressing, you know, letting the audience in on their thoughts.
You know, when they can say no and their face says yes, yes. You know, that sort of thing. Or
I'm not sure if this guy eating cereal is really trying to bait us or if he's just an idiot.
Exactly. Or I guess in the what's his name? Michael Emerson, who plays Ben on Lost, said one time, it's like his scripts are always like, he says it as truthfully as he can, more than he has ever been before. You know, he said that would come like every other script. So he's constantly playing this guy who's like trying to be dead honest and, you know, isn't.
Right.
And he does, it comes off, you know, even if you watch it, you're like, well, he might be saying the truth, you know.
Or maybe even the actor thinks he's saying the truth and... But he doesn't know if he is or not. But he has to act as if he is.
Well, I do know, and the scripts for Lost, besides having a lot of language in them, say a lot about the internal reactions of the characters. Mm. So I think that might communicate itself why the actors do such a good job of doing that.
That could be. I mean, I know when...
Is it a weird thing where the writing is overt so that the acting becomes implicit in some ways?
Well, that makes sense because acting and directing classes that way back in the day I would take, they would actually, there's a way to write out like beat for beat what the character's internal process is like. What are they thinking in this particular moment? And I don't know that, I mean, I'm not a professional at this, and I don't think actors generally try to keep that thing in their mind as they're going through the scene, but it's good background information so that they understand, they're not just reading a lot, you know, repeating lines from a page, but they understand the internal process of what a character is doing. And that's a lot of background work that will never be explicitly on screen or on the page.
It's interesting. We actually decided to pick this conversation because you were reading Allegiant.
Yes.
And you made some observations.
Well, I've observed this when Allegiant just kind of reminded me of it, how even authors who are just writing fictional books have to act in a certain sense and have to imply characters' actions and motivations in a certain way. And sometimes writers can overact a little bit. Like they want to express the character's feeling by making them punch a wall or furrow their brow or this and that. And sometimes
tug on their hair. That's something from Wheel of Time. There's a lady who's always tugging on her hair.
And I noticed that it was a I liked the Veronica Roth's books a lot, the Divergent series, which I'll talk about in the second half. But like one tell I noticed a lot, she did a lot, was having characters like chew on the inside of their cheek. Mm-hmm. And at first it was just like the main characters, like, okay, this is a quirk of hers. But then like other characters would do it and be like, I don't think that's that common of a quirk. But anyway.
But it communicates the emotion. Yeah. Because here's the thing. As a writer, you want to show and not tell. So you don't say, she's angry, so you say, or she's anxious, she chews on her cheek.
Yeah.
But the problem is, it still becomes, or it can still become overacting.
Yeah.
I know Wheel of Time occasionally, there were certain things that especially the Aes Sedai, the women would do all the time that people would, they become, I mean, granted, there's 14 books and 600 pages. I mean, things repeat.
Sure.
And,
sure.
But there's, you know, there's this sort of like, clicking tongues and they're I don't remember where they are now, but they came up a lot.
Uh-huh.
It's one of those things too where I know I learned, or I've learned more and more over time as a writer. You start with like, he said angrily, or he said stomping his feet, you know, all these actions but as you get better at implying, the dialogue itself takes care of the emotion.
Mm-hmm.
Now again, some dialogue you need that because it can be read two ways, or it's supposed to be read in the opposite of normal.
Yeah, and when you have a scene when a character finally loses it or whatever, you know, it makes sense. But, you know, unless your character's constantly blabbing his mouth, he doesn't know how to shut up, you know, he's constantly kind of one of these people, most people are not going to, like, go through some of the outward, like, you know, great...
Like rolling your eyes should not happen too much.
Yeah.
You know, occasionally, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, if they roll their eyes a lot...
Or constantly clenching their fists or...
Or their teeth.
Yeah. So you have to be careful about that. And, you know, find some creative ways to kind of...
Like pacing. I found in Strin Fred, there's a lot of pacing.
Oh, really? As you've
well,
gone back...
Well, Fred especially, but it's one of those things I have to really pay attention to.
I mean, it's certainly
good.
Fine. If it's a character quirk, if it's something that character does a lot, it can kind of make sense.
Yeah.
But you have to... balance it.
So what are the benefits and what are the downsides? I mean, obviously we've been talking pretty like there is a good thing generally.
Implying things. Yeah.
So that's what we're implying. So.
Well, what are the downsides? I think we've sort of hit that in our exposition discussion a bit. You know, sometimes, like I said, you can't constantly cover your message. We've been talking a lot about the character implications because there's a lot. You know, you talk about the iceberg thing. Most characters, they have a whole iceberg of backstory and what have you beneath them. And sometimes you want to actually dig into that backstory and explore it. Yeah. And sometimes it's just more of a hint.
A hint, yeah.
Like, they really like Sudokus.
Why not?
Yeah, I guess. I guess that's more color. It's not really backstory. But anyway.
Yeah. Well, and then sometimes there's parts of the world like, I don't know if this would count, but I wonder... It was a big deal when J.K. Rowling said that Dumbledore was gay.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. But I wonder if there was implication, you know, very subtle stuff in the book. I've only read the books once. But, you know, because it would obviously change how you... It might change how you write certain parts of the character. Maybe it doesn't.
Uh-huh.
But I know long-term mystery books that unrelated to that particular issue. Long-term books that have mystery, like the Harry Potter series, there'll be clues that they'll leave... that you can pick up on, then maybe later book becomes a plot point, or maybe not.
Uh-huh.
Like, oh, that's why those people were doing that, you know, especially in mysteries of sorts.
Yeah, or sometimes even fantasy books, if you have some sort of throwaway detail that, you know, applies, like I'm thinking just in Newell's Rising, just because it's the one I'm most familiar with, we mentioned the Imperial Fields of Abilium or something like that. And the implication was this, because they were talking about, like, there was a conversation about produce, which was kind of a plot thread to be dealt with later. It wasn't a huge deal in that book. But I didn't say anything else about it except that you just kind of got the idea that there's this settlement, this area somewhere where that supplies a lot of the Empire of Therian's food. Or at least it did before the cataclysm.
So, like, the implication both lives us... It's like a shadow through fog in some way, you know, like it's, in some ways it adds mystery that might get solved, like, oh, there's something there and we'll go fix it. Or sometimes it just adds depth.
Yeah.
You have a stage, but it makes it look like it's bigger than it is, you know, like for a world or whatever.
Sure.
And then sometimes it's, you know, more in the character thematic thing. It's more this gentle touch that makes it feel like it's nuanced or it's
There's some unstated reason why the character thinks this way.
Yeah. Or you're having a theme through the whole, you know, a real subtle theme that's just kind of implied through. It's one of those things that it holds all together. And you can go and dig deep, like, oh, this is why is why Huck does this and not that or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess if nothing else, implication tends to widen a book, deepen a book in many ways. Because if you just say it straight out, it just is. Yeah. It's like we talked about with music. It's the abstract version of we like
of an idea.
Yeah, we'd like to talk about. Have we talked about in here that comic book about comic books?
Understanding Comics?
Yeah.
Is that the one? Scott McCloud is the one who wrote it. I think it's Understanding Comics.
I don't know if we mentioned it here.
I don't know if we have or not.
It's a very good book.
Yeah, really interesting book. If you're curious about why, if you've got kids and they're into comic books or graphic novels or in general, if you just like to understand the phenomenon more, it's a great tool for that. But one of the concepts from it that stuck with Nick and I the most from it is he talks about abstract art, which most Christians don't really care for abstract art too much because, you know, we believe in an objective truth. There's things that are true, capital T, and abstract art tends to kind of
say it's very subjective. And,
yeah. But the advantages he pointed out of abstract art is the more. I think what he used a lot for this was a smiley face. Yeah. You know, if you have just your generic smiley face, two dots and a smile, it's very generic. You can different people can read different things into that. The more abstract something is, you know, clouds. You look at a cloud, one person sees a bunny, another person sees a horse.
So implication is, I guess, similar, not quite the same thing, where the more you imply things, the more it gives a sense of depth, of layers, of... It's not necessarily one thing yet.
Yeah, it's not cut and dried.
Yeah.
It's,
which maybe you don't want, but can add a lot of, I think that's why art, you know, fine art, I have air quotes here, tends to thrive on implication. All the art critics love books that are more vague and more, and then you get into the ambiguous, which is a whole different related issue.
Right.
But yeah, I guess it's more difficult or more masterful to not say things outright.
Right. And there's a time and place for both things.
Yeah.
I think there's a, to borrow a page from Ecclesiastes.
Yeah.
There's a time to be blunt and there's a time to be vague.
So this really is our flip side to our exposition.
Yeah. So you should go check that out sometime. Not that we're telling you to stop this podcast now. Keep listening, please.
Yes, please. It's very good.
But go check that out sometime. Are there more examples of, okay, what about Ray Bradbury? Did he like to imply in themes, or was he more straightforward, do you think?
He's strange, but he's very poetic in the sense, normally you know what he's talking about, but he'll ramp up the emotion to like 110%. Hmm. So I'm not sure it's the same thing.
Okay.
But there's books like, I'm going to talk about this more in the second half, but Tarkin, the book Tarkin, a Star Wars book.
Uh-huh.
But there was actually quite a bit of, they never quite state stuff outright. There's like this kind of this cat and mouse game between the Empire and these rebels, not the official rebels, but these terrorists.
Okay.
And a lot of times it was almost stated after the fact how things were connected. Hmm. It's like, it was just kind of stated as if you should have been keeping up with them.
Oh, so interesting.
So it was interesting. So it was much more subtle than I was used to in that sort of novel.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was almost more throwaway. I'm like, and you know, and it just kind of, they expect you to follow this sort of logic without spending a lot of time explaining it. Uh-huh. I thought it was pretty interesting. I hadn't had that in a book for a while. And I think things like, I want to say The Forever War, which I read, was books like that read slower because there's a lot that happens between the sentences in some ways.
Uh-huh.
Now, they don't describe everything. It goes from action to action or emotion to emotion. And you have to kind of read between, you have to build up the transitional things in some places. There's some old sci-fi is kind of like that.
What about in cases, because you talked about implied themes earlier.
Yeah.
Implied themes are a little strange, though, because they're usually like say, we'll go back to Lost, because that's kind of have it on the brain tonight. Apologize for those of you who don't like it. You know, there's often a theme of fathers.
Yeah.
You know, just because there's a lot
everywhere.
Of them. It's everywhere. So there you have theme by repetition, in a sense.
Yeah. Theme by repetition. I like that.
And maybe this is a completely different topic, the whole theme thing. But like, what I'm trying to think of another good example of where, like, we've been talking a lot about implied messages. I'm trying to think of some good examples of it.
Well, okay, I'm going to go back to, we'll go back to favorites just because those are the ones I've studied the most. But like Dostoevsky,
mm-hmm.
there's obviously a theme, but it's played in so many different notes in so many different ways. It's not direct by any means. And that might not be the same as implicit.
Okay. But how about this then? Because an example we both are very familiar with, Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
To say that Lord of the Rings are all about preserving nature would miss half the point.
Yeah.
But that it is certainly an implied theme of it about the, enjoying the outdoors.
The love of nature comes through very clearly.
The anti-view of industrialization. Yeah. I mean, that gets picked up a little bit more explicitly in the movies, just because you see it.
Yeah.
But even then, they're not really talking that much about it.
Well, it's interesting. You know, sometimes as Christian artists, we wrestle with, hey, how much should I talk about, directly about Christian things or not? And what's interesting, I think, is the more something is intrinsically part of you, you tend to imply it in works just because that's, I think that's what Tolkien was doing. I don't know they set out to say, I'm going to write against industrialization. I think he just felt very strongly about.
He had ideas.
Yeah.
He had ideas that just naturally tended to.
I think
express
it's very
themselves.
Hard not to imply things if it's something that is part of your worldview that you deeply believe. It's hard not for it to come through, just naturally. Just bleed through. You take a mark and write in paper and it bleeds through the other side. I think that's maybe how a lot of implication works. I mean, unconscious or semi-conscious implication.
But sometimes it has to be a conscious decision to unconsciously let it bleed through.
Yeah.
You know, if you're too concerned about, we've said this before, we're probably retreading old ground again, but if you're too conscious about getting a certain message across, that's, you're not implying it, you're forcing it. As opposed to, I don't know, there's ideas that like, if you... Well, here's another example from New World's Rising, which maybe I shouldn't go back to, but I enjoyed having the Defiant, evil rebel group. I enjoyed having them basically disdain motherhood, basically because of Amira, who is a mother who left. And I don't talk about this a whole lot, but like the Defiant have women in their ranks and they recruit women forcibly for war purposes. But they actually have this, because of Amira, they have this like, or we're going to leave mothers behind because their divinities are low. Their loyalties are divided.
Yeah. And their divinities are loyal.
And I purposely enjoy putting that in there because I think there's, in modern culture, there's a very strong push for women being involved in things, but mothers are kind of left.
Like the draft? I won't pull that in there, sorry.
Yeah, okay. I hadn't even thought about that, but what I mean. Modern feminism is a lot about the glory of womanhood, and women can be whatever they want, but okay, if you want to be a mother, fine, whatever.
Okay, and now we're right. I got a good example now. Okay, you watched, I didn't watch it, but I heard the end of one of the seasons of Legend of Korra.
Uh-huh, yeah.
It was highly implied, or people say it was implied that she committed suicide or was thinking about suicidal thoughts. That's season one.
Season one.
And then season three has an implication too, apparently. Is that right?
Season four?
Okay, I didn't watch it.
The suicide thing...
Or was that
I don't
conspiracy
know
the, theory?
It was almost conspiracy theory. Like, I don't... Because they never really got... You could read it into it, but they never. Yeah, that one's kind of iffy.
Okay.
Season four, I don't know if this is what you're talking about, but in season four, they started dropping hints pretty much throughout the season that Korra and Asami were.
Yeah.
Had,
oh, like Mulan in Once Upon a Time.
Yeah, basically.
That was just kind of.
Yeah.
Like when it happened and implied, I'm like, what? I didn't catch that at all, but everyone else on the internet is like, oh.
No, they were dropping little things about them having an interest. And
at
the very end, they kind of go off somewhere hand in hand. And it's not explicit, but it's very obviously implied or heavily implied, which is like almost the same thing. So,
but you could be the thing with implicit, implied things. You can miss if you're not paying attention.
Yes. Yeah.
Which I apparently missed, which I've missed stuff like that before, oh, that's what happened. Like, what? Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It's
double takes.
It's I don't know. It is, I guess, the one potential drawback to implying things, as we said before.
Yeah.
If you bury it too deep, people might miss it.
Well, and then sometimes people use it to bury things.
Yeah.
On purpose. I mean,
that's
like, I want to say this, but I can't get away with it.
They don't want to draw too much attention to it.
I think Hitchcock would do that, you know.
Yeah, probably.
You know, like, I can't get around what do they call those laws?
Hays Code?
Yeah.
Well, that's kind of what he said. His greatest money shot. Have you heard? I don't remember if Brian's told you this, but at the end of North by Northwest.
Okay.
Basically, Cary Grant and the leading lady, he's pulling her up onto their bunk bed, but they're apparently on a train, and then the train goes into a tunnel. And he said that was his money sex shot, basically. The train going into
okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And see, you wouldn't even thought
I wouldn't
that if
know,
I
would never.
Told you that.
Yeah. But, you know, people do that. I mean,
people do that.
People do that. So
for good and for evil, I guess.
Yes. It's like puns. Like sometimes they're good and sometimes you're like, no.
That didn't work.
Or not that sort of pun.
Yeah.
So, all right.
Well, on that note, sorry to kind of bring down the quality of our podcast here.
Yes.
We've gone all lewd. But we'll move on into our soundtrack. Okay, for my soundtrack today, I decided to go with something from The Legend of Zelda.
Dun, dun, dun.
Because Link is a silent protagonist. Nintendo...
You get those occasionally.
Oh, yeah, you
like
do get
Chrono.
Those. Yeah, well, it's primarily in video games where the creators want the gamer to feel like they are the character they're playing. They don't have... When the protagonist is silent, then they get to kind of inject themselves more. It's
you
the abstract
are everybody.
Thing. Yeah, basically. But I think you could also read, if you don't want to be Link and you want to give Link his own personality, I think you can read in the lines some about him. So anyway, this is from Legend of Zelda Ocarina of Time. Nick actually mentioned this last episode. This is Gerudo Peoples. And it's remixed by Scott Peoples.
Yay, Scott Peoples. This was one of my first, like... I love this one. This is pretty early.
This is a very old one. It's like from 2000.
Nice.
So enjoy. And we're back.
Hello, everyone.
Hope you enjoyed grooving out to Gerudo.
Gerudo? Gerudo? I don't know. Almost every Gerudo remix is awesome, though.
It's a very catchy song, as the best of video game music it should be.
Koji Kondo, that is his name?
Yeah.
He's very good.
Koji Kondo.
Yeah.
We are going to move on to our next segment now, which will be our take
on Tales.
So, do you want to flip a coin to see who goes first this time? Well, actually, we can't since we're in a spaceship.
Yeah,
so
we could flip it, but I'm not sure how it would stop. When it hits the ceiling, maybe, and bounces off.
Maybe. That might be dangerous.
Yeah.
So, anyway.
First one get thrown in an airlock loses.
All right. Why don't you go ahead and go first?
So we did do a Take on Tales a couple episodes ago on TV, but we thought we'd do a book one.
It's been a while since we tackled books.
Yes, exactly. And we've been reading some stuff. So,
yay.
I'm not sure whether I'll just do two today. One is Warbreaker by Brandon Sanderson.
Oh, I thought you had this was going to be an all Star Wars one.
No, it's not. I wanted to pull this one in. Warbreaker by Sanderson. It's a standalone fantasy novel, which was part of the reason I read it because I'm like, okay, good. I can handle a standalone. I got it done right before Mercy was born. Natasha's reading it as we record.
But
it was interesting. It took me a while to get into. Like, it wasn't bad by any means, but it took me a while to get used to the characters. Basically, there's these two sisters. The oldest, they're princesses. The oldest is pledged to be married to the god king of the city as part of this treaty. But they send the younger sister instead, who was never prepared to marry the god king. So you have the younger sister being married to this god king. You have the older sister feeling guilty and going to try to rescue her. And then you have kind of this character running around that seeming to want to do a rebellion of some sort in the city. There's war coming between these two nations, or breaker. And there's also, there's god king, but there's other gods, and one of the main characters is the god named Lightsong, who doesn't believe in his own religion. So it's very interesting. It took me a while to be, I'm like, things with gods like that, I'm just like, this is weird. But they play it so like, they're just gods because they return, like someone dies and then they come back. And then they're like, have super strength and stuff.
Oh,
like,
weird.
But there's no rules really for why they come back.
Okay.
It seems random. And so that's kind of how this city has made their base of religion on it. They come back, they're a god in their minds.
Okay.
Anyways, weird. Kind of funky. Before we get into it, the characters are very interesting. One thing I really enjoyed about it, once I got used to the world, I really liked it. The magic is pretty interesting. The characters are great, all the characters, the bad characters, the good characters. And Sanderson is great characters. But I think what I most appreciate about it was that the flip he did with all the characters. Like, the two sisters move a lot in different directions. I mean, there's a lot of character growth for a single book. Who you think are good guys, you know, the various, like, the mercenaries and the rebellion-seeming guy, Vasher, they do a lot of flipping. There's a lot of, like, almost, like, things are parallel in one way, and then by the end of the book, like, everyone's flip sides. Or, like, their personality has changed so much, it's almost like they're on the other end of where they were to begin with.
Huh.
So there's a lot of this parallelism and a lot of this, I don't know, structurally, that was really fascinating. Took me a while to get into. Once about halfway, I was hooked. The ending, it left me a little like, it almost like it was too quick. Like, it was a good action-packed ending, but then I'm like, it felt like a lot of build-up for an ending that was good, and I'm not sure what I would change, but I'd almost wanted
more epilogue?
More something. More, and I don't know what if it's more epilogue or more just I like these characters and you just dropped them or I don't know. But for standalone fantasy, I enjoyed it.
How would you compare it to previous Sanderson books that you've talked about on this podcast?
I know. See, I'm eventually going to try to make it through all Sanderson because I don't have his Jordan anymore. It's better than Arithmetist. Arithmetist is a neat idea. Weirdly paced. Like, the last chapter is the best chapter of the whole book. It's just odd. And it's like an epilogue chapter. The Reckoners, which is like Steelheart and Firefight, those are more like action-y. Like, they're more compact, so it's hard to compare. Mm-hmm. Probably equal with those. Nothing really beats the Way of Kings and Words of Radiance, just because those are so massive. And Words of Radiance, for being 1,000 pages, the plotting on that book is astounding. I mean, like, there's no wasted space in that book.
Uh-huh.
So, I would say middling. Like, good. Like, I enjoyed it. I'd recommend it to Natasha. Not quite rant level. Like, I love it.
Or rave level.
Or rave. Yeah, I guess rave level. That's what I meant. Okay. Rant level is something different.
All right, let's talk about Tarkin then.
Tarkin. Okay, so then I decide, hey, there's only 7 Star Wars books in the new canon. Zach's been listening to them audio. I'm like, maybe I'll try one, see if I like it, and maybe I used to read a lot of Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
Tarkin was kind of, I really liked Tarkin. Not the character, but I mean, but this book is a, it takes place, I don't know, 10 years before the first movie or something like that.
Okay.
They're building the Death Star.
Uh-huh.
He's in charge of the secret base that is building the Death Star.
For those who aren't Star Wars nerds like us,
yes.
We probably should say who Tarkin is.
He's Grand Moff Tarkin. He's in the New Hope. He's the guy who basically blows up Alderaan.
Yeah, well, and he's kind of outranks Vader, weirdly enough.
The cool thing about this book, several cool things. One, the backstory on Tarkin, like his home planet, and like he has this kind of like Call of the Wild sort of rite of passage his whole family does to every generation. So he's been like out there hunting animals barehanded and stuff. So it's
okay.
That's really interesting how they play that in. His relationship, because this book's largely about how he and Vader became, I don't know if friends is a too strong word, but co-workers. Co-workers. Yeah. Because by the end of the book, basically it's basically the Emperor, Tarkin, and Vader are kind of like the dark triumvirate of the Empire.
Does it mention, now that I think about this, does it mention Thrawn at all?
It does not.
That's interesting.
Why?
Well, I don't know. Just Thrawn being as an important character as he was in a book that's all about the Imperial underpinnings, you'd think they'd at least mention him.
Well, the problem is, I really think, because Thrawn is such a popular character, they're probably not going to touch on a 10-foot pole in the new canon.
Yeah.
Because as soon as you say Thrawn, it brings in it brings up in people's mind 10,000 other things.
Yeah. It's just kind of sad, though, because
he's a great character.
If you think about, I hadn't thought about this before now, but that might actually be kind of a confirmation that some of those guys aren't going to be in the new canon.
That's true. I mean, Thrawn could still have been pretty low key at 10 years before.
Yeah, it's possible. I guess we don't really know.
I mean, there was only a couple. I mean, Moffs, according to the book, were basically governors of large areas,
mm-hmm.
and Tarkin got the Grand Moff title made especially for him.
Oh, okay.
To kind of be over whole sectors. The other thing about this book that was fascinating is just, it was so technical. Like, the names of ships and things. I mean, it was not your normal, like, swashbuckling Star Wars. It was a very much a kind of a political, like, mystery sort of. It was paced pretty slow, but it was fascinating stuff. And then it pulled in a lot of Clone Wars stuff,
uh-huh.
which I haven't watched, but you could really tell that it was that the canon of that really worked together. I mean, Tarkin basically guessed that Darth Vader was Anakin.
Okay, yeah.
He could never get confirmation, but...
That's interesting. I've come around a little bit in terms of, maybe because of Clone Wars, and the idea that Star Wars can take a lot of different forms of storytelling, in a sense. I used to not like that idea, but I'm kind of coming around. And I guess, and even partly because the prequels are very different type of stories than original trilogies, and different than a lot of other Star Wars stories.
I don't think Tarkin could have been written without the prequels, not just because of the time, but I think because the prequels were so political and created such a more of a structure, it created books like Tarkin can exist.
And but you couldn't have done it as well if you didn't know what the rest of the world was like, is what you're saying. Because, back when all we had original trilogy, anything that was Old Republic was kind of shrouded in mystery.
Yeah, exactly.
And so now this is the only time now you can actually delve into some of that
and then
stuff.
The third thing I love about it is the idea, the Tarkin's mainly thing about ruling through fear and examining, he thinks he's right. I mean, having a bad guy as the main character is very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But that the Old Republic was corrupt, and so he's trying to make a more efficient, better run government. And that there really is, it's wrong, but this sense that, and it plays out in real politics and both in like Roman history and you could arguably say nowadays, that, too much freedom, people just get corrupt, therefore we need to make everything organized and
unilateral
and, unilateral and systematized and...
Mm.
Those sort of big ideas are very interesting to me in a Star Wars, because you didn't get those in the ones I used to read back in the Thrawn days, because it wasn't a topic.
Sure.
But you didn't have that sort of rotting Republic idea.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
So anyways, I liked it. And then I guess I'll just as an addendum, I've started A New Dawn, which is also a new Star Wars movie. I'm about halfway through it. Much more your swashbuckling.
A new Star Wars movie?
I mean book.
Book, yeah.
It's right, but it leads into Rebels, which I have not watched either. Much more your swashbuckling, Han Solo, espionage, action sort of stuff.
I like, I'm just looking at your cover here, and it's nice to see that, because this is the character from the cartoon, right?
Yeah.
It's nice, it's just cool to see him in a different art style.
Yeah, and you can tell he's a little more not cartoony, even in his personality, or not. I mean, I think Rebels is a little younger.
Yeah, I think it skews a little younger even than Clone
and
Wars.
And he's a little, he goes getting drunk every night, and, you know, he's like the hair of the Twi'lek, he's like, you know, wants to hit on and stuff.
I think it's Twi'lek.
Twi'lek? Okay.
I'm not sure.
I don't know. But, and I'm not watching, so maybe it's like that in the cartoon. My guess is it's not particularly explicit here, but it's talked about.
Yeah, just, which probably would not be on a Disney XD show, honestly.
And this one also talks about the whole, like, the main bad guy is this Count Vidian, who's basically a efficiency expert, like a businessman. But he's like half, he's like almost all cybernetic, and he doesn't care what happens to people as long as it works and it works fast. Okay. Which is very much an empire sort of, it's like...
Yeah, efficiency.
But it's just a very interesting, I like this theme of the Republic become the empire and the changes that happened. I don't know, but I hadn't read that sort of stuff before.
Cool.
So that's that. I've enjoyed Tarkin quite a bit. This one's been good.
But it's early yet.
Yeah. Well, I'm halfway through. But I think Tarkin is probably a little more my favorite of the two.
Okay.
Okay, and you, Tim?
I tackled the Divergent trilogy.
Oh, yes. Yes, we mentioned that.
Yeah, we did mention that. I plowed through it maybe faster than it was healthy. I don't know. just over the last month and a half or so.
Nice.
Maybe I'm a little late to the boat. I mean, they're getting ready for the last movie. Well, I guess maybe they split the last book into two again.
Why not?
Anyway.
Allegiant and Allegianer.
Yeah. I had family that recommended it. I knew Natasha really liked it. And I really enjoyed it, too. It's by Veronica Gray.
Veronica Roth.
I knew that wasn't right. Veronica Roth. If you aren't familiar with the basic story, it's young adults, post-apocalyptic dystopian, as many of them are.
No werewolves.
Yeah. In this one, it takes place in a city that used to be Chicago, basically. There are different factions that are based off of basically... traits, I guess, or virtues, depending on how you look at it. There's like the Dauntless, who value courage. They each have a name that means basically the same thing as like the more common name for it.
But it sounds cooler.
It sounds cooler, yeah.
Amity.
Amity. Abnegation is basically the selflessness. They're almost like the Amish in a sense. They try to lead very selfless lives and do all this stuff. Whereas then there's the erudites, who are the scholars and the seeking knowledge and all that sort of thing. But anyway, the main character, her birth name is Beatrice. She leaves her family's faction because all the youth at they have a coming of age ceremony basically when they're 16, and where they choose which faction, whether to stay with their family's faction or they go to another one. And she chooses to go to the Dauntless, the warriors, the courageous type people. And so really, and what I didn't expect, because from the movie trailer, it looks like, because they also introduced very early on in the book's idea of Divergent, where you have aptitude for multiple of these factions, which you're not supposed to be, supposedly. And
fit in your whole square peg.
Yeah. And if you just look at the trailer, I saw the trailer like before Hunger Games or something. Yeah. And I got the impression that, she found out she's Divergent, so the rest of the movie is about her training to fight the power, basically, like you do.
Who doesn't fight the power? Come on.
But the first book is not really about that at all. It's more about her training to be part of her faction. I mean, there are obviously conflicts come up over the course of the three books, but not always in the ways you expect. And I'm not going to go into a lot of the specifics. It's interesting, the third book, this is a little spoiler, I guess, but the third book is paced very differently than the other two. The first two are very like, you know, hard hitting, lots of action scenes. And the third book kind of takes a step back and a breather as they kind of explore the greater world, which I actually really appreciated, because even in the first two books, I didn't completely buy the world setup. Like, why would society set itself up this way?
Yeah.
From reader's perspective, it seems pretty obvious that you should be able to embrace more than one of these virtues. Yeah. You know, the kind of single-mindedness the factions encourage is not healthy.
Yeah.
So from an outside perspective, you're like, why would society actually set itself up that way? And it's not until the third book where, I mean, and you go along with it just because you're like, well, okay, this is the story. Suspend disbelief. Yeah. I'll go with it.
It's really a movie you really should just relax.
Yeah, basically. And, you know, if you didn't have the story, it's still an interesting way to explore ideas. And she explores lots of interesting ideas. But in the third book, they kind of give a what I think is a better explanation for the world at large and how this all got set up. But what I really appreciate about these books, I mean, they're definitely page turners. You definitely want to keep reading to find out what happens next. And good central characters. Beatrice renames herself Triss, and she gets into, of course, a romantic relationship with a guy.
What's his name?
He's introduced as Four.
Okay, but you talked about a Five earlier in the podcast.
About what?
A guy named Five.
Ironically, I didn't even think about that. Completely unrelated.
So now we have 4, 5, 6, and 7 in the podcast. It's like a Sesame Street podcast.
Anyway.
Sorry.
So you've got that romance thing going on. But what I really appreciated was the way that she explored ideas. And Veronica Roth at least professes to be a Christian author and definitely has a different perspective to the dystopian scene that I've seen, you know, even from Hunger Games or I haven't read that many dystopian books, but it felt markedly different than what a secular version of this would be, in that there is a sense of hope. She gets the themes of forgiveness way more often than most authors I've seen.
Yeah.
And these are not marketed as Christian books in any way. They're marketed to a secular audience.
You think Katniss not particularly forgiving?
Forgiveness is not really something that Katniss thinks a lot much about. Katniss is much more focused on survival, and which is understandable, but the Hunger Games books in general kind of have that, and they don't go into full-on nihilism, but there's still sort of that sense of there's no one really good, we just kind of trudge along, basically.
Nothing really matters.
But Divergent, you get a sense that there is hope and that love between individuals is a huge redeeming factor for a lot of characters. And I don't know, it was just really refreshing because it still has all the kind of hard-hitting kind of ideas of survival and rough terrain that dystopians have, but it never felt nihilistic to me. And that can be a fine line sometimes.
Yeah. Have you seen the movies?
I've not seen the movies yet. I've heard they're substantially different, or at least they turn different at some point.
Yeah. I don't remember what Natasha... I know Natasha said the second one is substantially different. I think the first one's closer.
Okay.
But I could be wrong on that.
Well, I'll probably try to catch up because I know the first Allegiant movie comes out in like next month or so.
Soon, yeah.
Relatively soon. So if that sounds something that's interesting to you, you know, check it out. I guess I should say it was interesting. The romantic scenes were a bit more intimate than I'm used to reading. Not that they never really explicitly crossed the line, but in terms of like where they place their hands where they kiss, and it's like I'm not used to reading.
They implied more than you would like.
Yeah. There wasn't really implication at that point. I wouldn't mind if they applied a little bit more, honestly. But, you know, that's just me being a guy.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that's, go check it out if that sounds interesting.
Awesome.
And I think that's pretty good for our take on Tales.
That'll work.
We're going to wrap up with one more segment here, and that will be Project Update. Okay, Nicholas.
Hi.
What have you been doing over at your website or in your other various projects?
Well, I think since we last did Project Update, I have done, two things. One is that for Children Wells fans, the two of you out there, we were nearly done editing Greg's novel. And that I had a lot to do with the final edit on that, or the final content edit, I guess.
Yeah. And I know we've said it's really close for a long time.
No, but it is really close. I mean, this thing's large. It's a full novel.
It's a full novel.
But I think it'll be enjoyable. So that I was very happy to be done with that. Or there's a couple pages left. And then there's this story called... I probably mentioned Sorism on here at some point, didn't I?
Oh, yeah. Probably.
Anyway, this is a barbarian story we did for this Pulp Fiction project. If we've talked about it before, it would have been in relation with... I just lost. What's the
Wild
Monster book.
Oh, Destroyer.
Destroyer, thank you. Yes. All I could think was Godzilla. I'm like, it's not Godzilla. Destroyer came from that same project. And I've Sorzin was a barbarian story that I started and then Aaron and Nathan worked on. And I finally did my, Nathan's been bugging me for many moons to do an edit on that. So I did my complete edit, which is, for me was retyping the whole thing in my own words, because I just don't like having different styles, even if they're good, because it just is weird to me.
Sure.
Tweaks himself. So hopefully at some point that'll be available in some manner. Nathan's still got kind of okay it because he wrote a lot of the original.
Sure.
And then for the 28th time ever.
I was going to say, Zorzan was distraction number 532, you know, right?
Okay, here's a story about how apparently things work. So with the baby, not much creative juices lately.
Uh-huh.
And I got done with Greg's thing, and Sorzan been done before that. I'm like, okay, I should start to work on something else. And I'm like, it's about the time for Strint and Fred.
Strint and Fred?
I know, Strint and Fred. But I just was not feeling it at all. And then I opened up the old file from the second part of the third book that I'm working on and read a couple chapters. And I'm like, oh, this is good. I forgot all this. And suddenly I was like, ready to go again.
Oh, cool.
I thought about to start writing, but there are so many threads, and the Strin section I'm working on right now is very complicated thematically, because there's
a lot of implications you have to make.
Yes, exactly. Or just all the characters are doing at the same time.
Uh-huh.
So I'm like, oh, I'll just start typing up what I have from last time. So I've typed about 4,000 words, and that's nice because it gets me back into it. I'm excited. But here's the thing. As soon as I start writing Strin Fred, I get creative about lots of other things. And I think I have jokingly said to Natasha the other day, if I ever finish Strin Fred, I will never be able to write anything else either. Because for right now, as long as Strin Fred is not done, I have ideas for other things. So I don't think that's true, but
I don't think that's true.
I'm not promising anything about Strin Fred ever again, but I am working on it currently as I'm recording right now.
I don't see a notebook out, Nick.
Right here.
Oh, okay. There it is.
and I'm also, I guess I should mention the little kind of ad paper thing here in the Four County area. It's called the Four County Mall.
Okay.
Anyways, I have Flash Fictions in there every month now.
Oh, really?
They pay me.
So, oh, wow.
Yeah.
Like pulling from your catalog?
No, I do new ones.
Really?
Because, well, they want kind of local flair, so they're all kind of like real stories, not like my more fantastical ones.
Oh, okay.
And like the one that just came out, Bixler Lake's in it.
Oh,
so
cool.
I tried to place, because they want, you know, it's a local place. I mean, anyways. So that's fun. They pay me, and I get to write Flash Fictions, which, I mean, that's perfect.
That's very cool.
Yeah. So I have three of those that have been published. They're on my website, too. Normally, after they come out there, I have permission. I put them on my website. So, like...
Have you done that yet?
Yeah. Like, just Wednesday post... Wait, no. Last Friday, I posted my most recent one, White Expanse.
See, I think I might have missed that, because you've been posting on Facebook a lot of your old ones.
I have been posting a lot of my old ones. I guess this year I've also decided, just because my biggest problem is that no one knows me or reads me, I thought, hey, all year I'm just going to, every Monday, Wednesday, and most Fridays, promote something I wrote. Uh-huh. And I can get through most of the year that way. Well, I got 60-some Flash Fictions and a dozen good short stories and other projects. So
that's impressive.
I thought, at worst, someone might read or hasn't. At best, I guess someone might read it. At worst.
Someone might read it. No.
At worst, it just is a nice reminder to me of, oh, wait, I have done something while I was not doing Strin Fred. So
that's cool. I would just like to mention, too, that not long after Mercy was born, I was reminded of a phone conversation I got from you, or a phone call I got from you back when...
About a story I need to write?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, about a certain story that I was really intrigued by from you, but you said, originally you told me that you didn't feel like you could write it until you'd had a wife who had gone through
pregnancy. Pregnancy. Now we've done it three times. So,
it's
not done yet, so it could do it any time. Actually, that idea... there was this called Fiction Vortex. They were opening up for, you make a world and then like people can serialize different stories in it.
Mm-hmm.
And they were having a contest to make a world. And I'm like, I was really tempted to make that world and do it. Except at the time, like I couldn't swing doing it.
Uh-huh.
I knew that, as excited as I was about it, I couldn't keep up with it at that point because Mercy was about ready to come and et cetera. Mm-hmm. So I had not forgotten that. I got a couple other ideas that now that I'm writing Strin Fred are coming to the forefront again. Like The Pain Machine. Someday I need to write The Pain Machine. Nathan, that's for you. All right. Tim, your project update.
Well, let's see. I was trying to think about where to go with this because I knew we hadn't done project update in a while. So if I was like,
you did a Muppet video.
Yeah. Had I mentioned that since the last time?
Have you?
That was way back in September.
Okay.
I did a Muppet vlog. I thought about doing another vlog about before the show came back on to talk about it. I just haven't gotten around to it. Which those of you who have listened for a while know, and I've expressed interest in continuing some YouTube work, but have never gotten around to it for a variety of reasons.
It's the curse of Strange Fred. When I finish Strange Fred, then you'll start your YouTube.
It's entirely possible. Now, I was talking with my roommate the other day about, because he's been starting to listen to podcasts, and he was asking, so have you done this? And it's like, well, or he was asking about how much I've written. And, you know, taught New Wells Rising and Story Project and a couple other things. And I was like, and there's various other projects that have been in the back burner for a while. And he's like, you mean like Darian's story? It's like, oh no, people remember that name now. Or at least they have the potential to if they go back and listen through podcasts. So
you are held responsible now.
Yeah, I know. It's weird having an audience sometimes. So I have not forgotten about those things. I'm still working through some personal issues and things that get me in the way. Where my creativity has been going more recently has been, we've done some very elaborate things at my church recently, which has been really fun. We did this huge thing for Super Bowl Sunday, where our church for several years now has, we do a food drive for our food pantry on Super Bowl with soup as in S-O-U-P.
Yeah.
And this, they went all out with like the football theme and basically formatted the service as if it was a Super Bowl broadcast, which included like a pregame show before the service even started. So between like that and like videos that we showed during the service, we had to produce like 15 minutes of original video content, which is way more than I've ever done for our church service before. But I mean, it was a lot of fun. We had like I said, there was like a pre-service thing. We did like player introductions as if the band was the worship band were like the teams, which I know you're not a sports person, or I'm not either, but you know, football teams will often say, you know, Timothy Deal, Taylor University, either their name and a school. That, so we did that. That was fun.
Awesome.
So, and we did a couple, we replayed one of our old commercials and we did a new one of spoofing like nationwide commercials.
Nice.
So it was fun. And so just little things like that. When was it? I did it for a junior high camp. The junior high winter camp this year was zombie themed.
Nice.
And so we did this thing where like the junior high pastor was like this German psychiatrist with a zombie. He's like, so when did you first start feeling that you were undead? So stuff, little projects like that have been fun.
Cool.
So I've been doing stuff behind the scenes, you know, obviously also managing the podcast.
Yeah, you do all the work on the podcast. Let's just sit here and look pretty.
And the weekly hijack.
Sound stuttery.
Sound pretty, I guess.
Sound stuttery.
So anyway, that's our project update.
If you would like to join with Project Update, we have a Jason's novel for you.
We are still looking for someone to
join our
Children of the Wells team.
Join the exciting management team at Children of the Wells. Earn benefits and experience.
Benefits?
You could be our friends.
Free cookies at meetings.
Miss Science Theater nights.
That sounds pretty good, honestly, to me.
I'll join. So.
Also, if there is something in our story school discussion about implications, you think there's something that we missed about another good example of a implied theme.
Yeah, but I know sometimes we're up here and our brains go dead for good examples. So.
Feel free to leave a comment about that at derailedtrainsofthought.blogspot.com.
Yes. You can also subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher. Leave us an iTunes rating. I guess that's a thing that helps.
Yeah, help us get attention.
Or just tell people about the podcast. From what I hear, the people who listen to it like it.
Yeah, I'm
so
crazy
tell more
enough.
People, and they might like it. They just haven't heard our melodious voices yet. You know what we need to do, though? You know, when you hear people's voices and you see them in real life, they're like completely different. We need to have faces for what we would look like from our voices.
That would be interesting. Have some fan art. If we ever had people who had never met one or both of us before, have them draw and see what we look like. That would be interesting. There's another challenge for you guys. All right, Nick. Man, the air in here is getting kind of thin.
I'm having trouble breathing.
It sounds like there's someone outside this place called Dave that the computer's talking to. I don't know. I'm feeling you better go ahead and introduce your soundtrack
Okay.
here. So let's leave.
So, implication made me think you test like mysteries and stuff, and Phoenix Wright has to figure out what the truth is from all the implications from the testimony or something like that. So that's my loose connection to Phoenix Wright.
Ace Attorney.
And in any case, I think it's called a cross-examination, sudden interjection.
That's correct.
All right, good. And I remember. And it's remixed by Prototype Raptor, which is a great name. but I don't know. I was just really digging this. I guess it's called downbeat, kind of hip-hop-y style. I don't know.
People objection. You should know.
I should know. I like it. That's all I care about.
I just had to say objection. That's all.
Objection.
Not so fast.
That's great. So anyways, please enjoy, and we need to get the podcast to get us out of here now.
Yeah, I agree. Let's open the podcast day doors and leave.
Okay.
The podcast. Because
I got it. Okay. Adios, everyone.
This has been Tim.
This is Nick.
Bye.
See you later, Space Cowboy.